From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Urban unrest escalates around France as riots continue throughout the country for an 11th straight night. We'll go to Paris to get a report. Then President Bush continues through Latin America after leaving Argentina and a failed summit to promote free trade in the region. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez led the opposition.
Porque el modelo capitalista, el modelo desarrollista.
The capitalist model, the developed model, the consumer model, which comes from the north, which it has forced on the world, is falling apart on Earth, and there is no planet nearby that we can immigrate to.
Y que se sepa, no tenemos ningún planeta cercano así para que emigremos hacia allá.
Then the fox and the hen house, how privatization threatens democracy.
Don't think of privatization as a matter of saving money for the taxpayer. What's really going on, Amy, is that a set of privatizing corporations linked to the Bush administration are trying to undo democracy to take away the very ground on which we have to stand and fight.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, 3,500 U.S. and Iraqi forces have launched a major offensive along the Syrian border. The New York Times reports it's the largest assault the Marines have conducted since the invasion of Fallujah in February. At least one U.S. Marine has been killed in fighting. The Iraqi death toll is unknown. U.S. warplanes have reportedly dropped 500-pound bombs on at least 10 locations. Most communication to the Sunni towns of Husayba and Qaim have been cut off. An Iraqi journalist in Husayba told Al Jazeera, quote, the city is suffering a complete lack of all of life's basic necessities. There's no fuel and winter is upon us. There's no food and there are no services whatsoever, not even health services. The journalist said ambulances have been unable to respond to emergencies because no movement is allowed in the city. One resident of Qaim told Reuters this weekend, residents have been forced to flee the town.
They destroyed Qaim. Americans bombed everything. Our houses are destroyed. Our children are victims, and we want a solution. What do we have to do? We need a solution.
Associated Press reported the U.S.-led forces warned over loudspeakers anyone leaving the town in vehicles would be shot. The U.S. said Operation Steel Curtain was needed to stop foreign fighters from crossing the Syrian border. Meanwhile, Sunni politicians criticized the U.S.-led attack. The head of the moderate Iraqi Islamic Party, Mohsen Abdulhamid, said, quote, we reject all military operations directed against civilian targets because such acts lead to the killing of innocent people and the destruction of towns and cities. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration was warned in February of 2002 that intelligence reports alleging ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda were likely fabricated by a member of al-Qaeda in U.S. detention. However, the Bush administration ignored the Defense Intelligence Agency warning that the detainee, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, was lying. His faulty claims were repeatedly used to justify the invasion of Iraq. 8 months after the DIA issued its warning, President Bush gave a major speech in Cincinnati in which he said, quote, we've learned Iraq has trained al-Qaeda members in bomb-making and poisons and gases. Earlier this year, Newsweek magazine revealed al-Libi may have begun speaking to interrogators after he was tortured. Al-Libi was captured in November 2001 in Afghanistan. He was handed over to the CIA for questioning and eventually flown to Egypt. The former head of the Iraqi National Congress, Ahmed Chalabi, is heading to Washington this week for his first official trip in over 2 years. He's planning on speaking at the American Enterprise Institute Wednesday, and he'll be meeting with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Treasury Secretary John Snow. Before the invasion of Iraq, Chalabi had close ties to the Pentagon, as well as some reporters, including Judith Miller of the New York Times. He's been accused of feeding fabricated information about Iraq's weapons capabilities to U.S. intelligence agencies and to journalists ahead of the Iraq invasion. Questions have also arisen over its close ties to Iran. Over the weekend, Chalabi was in Tehran for closed-door meetings with high-ranking Iranian officials, including President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Last year, the Defense Intelligence Agency concluded Iranian intelligence had used aides of Chalabi to pass disinformation to the United States. In France, unrest escalated around the country this weekend as youths continued rioting for an 11th straight night. On Sunday, rioters opened fire on police in a working-class suburb of Paris, wounding 10 officers. By Sunday, 3,300 cars had been destroyed throughout the country, along with dozens of public buildings and private businesses. More than 300 people have been detained. Earlier today, police announced the first fatality since the unrest began. A man died after being beaten while trying to extinguish a trash can fire. We'll go to Paris for a report in a few minutes. President Bush's trip to Argentina ended without any agreement on reviving talks to create a regional free trade zone. Brazil, Venezuela, Paraguay, Uruguay, and Argentina all declined to take part in further negotiations on the free trade area of the Americas. On Friday, as many as 40,000 demonstrators filled the streets of Mar del Plata in Argentina. Protesters included the Argentine Nobel Peace Prize winner Adolfo Perez Esquivel, the Bolivian presidential candidate Evo Morales, and the Argentine soccer star Diego Maradona. While Bush attended the Summit of the Americas, over 10,000 people rallied in a nearby soccer stadium for a counter-summit led by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. In news from Washington, President Bush has ordered all White House aides to take a refresher course on ethics. The briefings will focus in part on government rules about handling classified information. The announcement was made 2 weeks after the indictment of Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Meanwhile, a federal grand jury has subpoenaed Republican Congressmember Robert Ney as part of its investigation of lobbyist Jack Abramoff. The editors of the Washington Post are coming under criticism for the paper's reporting on the CIA's network of overseas secret prisons. Last week, the Post revealed the CIA was operating secret prisons in several Eastern European nations, but the paper agreed not to identify the countries under a request from the Pentagon. Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archives told the Columbia Journalism Review, quote, "This is probably the most important newspaper capitulation since the New York Times yielded to JFK's call for them not to run the full story of planning for the Bay of Pigs." Peter Kornbluh went on to say, quote, "By withholding the country names, the Post is directly enabling the rendition, secret detention, and torture of prisoners at these locations to continue. That is a ghastly responsibility," he said. Human Rights Watch has identified Poland and Romania as two likely locations for the secret prisons, but officials from both countries have denied the claim. Over the weekend, UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Manfred Nowak, urged the European Union and the Council of Europe to conduct high-level investigations into the allegations of secret CIA prisons in Europe. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration has greatly expanded the use of national security letters to secretly collect personal information about citizens. The Post reports the number of letters sent annually has increased from 300 to 30,000. The FBI has used national security letters since the 1970s, but the Patriot Act of 2001 made it easier for agents to issue the letters. The little-known procedure allows the FBI to secretly force businesses to hand over detailed information about individuals, even if they have no direct connection to a terrorist investigation. Businesses served letters are barred from disclosing anything about the request, including the fact that it was made. According to the Washington Post, such information collected could include where you make and spend money, what you buy online, where you travel, what you search for and read online, and who you call or email at home and at work. The best-known use of national security letters occurred in Las Vegas last year. After learning of an alleged terrorist threat, FBI officials ordered private businesses, including casinos, to hand over detailed information about every hotel guest in the city, every person who rented a car, every lease on a storage space, and every airline passenger who landed in the city. In other Iraq news, a United Nations auditing board has called on the United States to repay the Iraqi government $208 million. The UN board determined Halliburton's subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, overbilled and did shoddy work on reconstruction projects paid for with Iraqi oil revenue. Meanwhile, the Houston Chronicle reports five former Halliburton employers are suing the company, claiming they failed to pay workers in Iraq and Kuwait overtime. The lawsuit claims Halliburton shorted up to 40,000 truck drivers, cooks, and mechanics. The New York Times is reporting Kenneth Tomlinson is now being investigated for misusing funds of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Tomlinson is best known for his tenure at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He resigned from that post last week. He remains, however, chair of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the federal agency that runs Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and other overseas government broadcasts. In recent weeks, State Department investigators have seized records from the agency, including emails between Tomlinson and Karl Rove, President Bush's chief advisor. Meanwhile, the Financial Times reports the head of the U.S.-run Arabic satellite TV station Al-Hara has quit. Congress is looking into Al-Hara's financial affairs and programming and will hold a hearing next week. And public access TV stations across the country are planning on stopping programming tonight in protesting of new congressional legislation that could lead to the elimination of public access TV. At 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, scores of stations are planning to air 1 minute of snow. Anthony Riddle of the Alliance for Community Media said, quote, "This snowstorm is to remind communities what could be lost if new cable legislation before Congress is not fixed to protect the wonderful community channels we have all come to know and love." And that's some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Urban unrest has escalated around France this weekend as young people continue rioting throughout the country for an 11th straight night. On Sunday, rioters opened fire on police in a working-class suburb of Paris, wounding 10 officers. On Saturday night, rioting spread from the Paris suburbs into the more well-off districts. Also on Saturday, the rioting reached inside the French capital for the first time, with youth setting fire to more than 30 cars in central Paris. There were also reports of unrest in the cities of Cannes, Nice, Marseille, Lille, and Strasbourg. By Sunday, 3,300 cars had been destroyed throughout the country, along with dozens of public buildings and private businesses. More than 300 people have been detained. The New York Times reports the unrest is one of the most serious challenges to governmental authority in France in nearly 40 years. Many politicians have warned the unrest may be coalescing into an organized movement, citing internet chatter that's urging other poor neighborhoods across France to join in. The violence began on October 27th, following the deaths of two teenagers, one of Mauritanian origin and the other of Tunisian origin, in the poor area of Clichy-sous-Bois. The two teens were electrocuted in a power grid while fleeing from police. The suburbs are home to a large West African and North African community plagued by chronic unemployment and poverty. Unemployment in the neighborhoods is double and sometimes triple the 10% national average, while incomes are about 40% lower. France is home to the largest immigrant community in Europe, which makes up 10% of its 60 million population. One of France's largest Muslim organizations issued a fatwa condemning the violence, saying, quote, "It's strictly forbidden for any Muslim to take part in any action that strikes blindly at private or public property or that could threaten the lives of others." Meanwhile, the French government has come under increasing fire for its handling of the situation. Opposition parties have called for the Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, to resign after calling the young people scum last week. And French President Jacques Chirac was roundly criticized for not speaking publicly about the unrest until Sunday, after an emergency meeting with top members of his cabinet. This is the French President Jacques Chirac.
Je viens de réunir le Conseil de sécurité intérieure.
I just met with the Home Security Council. That's the Prime Minister and the ministers concerned by matters of public order. We took a certain number of measures to further reinforce the actions of police and justice, because today the absolute priorities to reestablish security and public order.
De nature à renforcer encore l'action de la police et de la justice.
And this is Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy speaking to reporters after the emergency meeting.
We met the Prime Minister, who thanked the forces of law and order for the quality of their work last night. It was a difficult night. Even if the police displayed a lot of presence on the ground, they worked with a degree of control that allowed us to avoid many, many incidents. There were more than 300 arrests. The order given by the Prime Minister is the same that I have given. Those who carry out these actions will be held accountable in front of the law. The plan is in place and the orders that have been given remain the same.
Ceux qui commettent les exactions auront à en rendre compte devant la justice.
The Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, who called the young people scum. Joining us from Paris is Peter Ford, a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you start at the beginning, how this all began at the end of October?
Well, as you say, there was an incident in which two young boys of immigrant descent in Clichy-sous-Bois were coming home from a football match that they'd been playing, and it seems that they spotted a police patrol. They were afraid of one of the identity checks that police go in for very heavily in these districts, and everybody scampered, fled. Three of the boys hid in a substation. One was very badly injured. Two were killed. And the rumor spread that they had been chased into that substation by the police, the implication being deliberately chased in, and that sparked the riots. I think what that speaks to, although the preliminary report suggests that they weren't being chased at the time, but the fact that they climbed over a 6-foot barbed wire wall to hide from police speaks volumes about the state of relations between young immigrant origin youth and police in these sorts of places. And also generally about how difficult it is to live in these quarters.
Mm. There have also been marches for peace in one of the hardest hit neighborhoods. Thousands of silent marchers in Aulnay-sous-Bois chanted no to violence, yes to dialogue. What kind of effect are they having?
Well, not much at the moment. As you heard Nicolas Sarkozy and President Jacques Chirac saying a few minutes ago, they are concentrating on law and order. The first priority, they said, is to restore order. Only then will the government start thinking about longer-term plans to attack the root causes of this problem. Dominique de Villepin, the Prime Minister, is due to go on television in about 6 hours to announce some measures. But dialogue is a difficult thing to call for at the moment because it's hard to see with whom one would really talk. The young men who are carrying out the violence are not answering, frankly, or listening to any figures of authority in their communities at the moment. The mosques, the imams are preaching against violence. The local social workers are trying to get through to them. But so far, they haven't had any effect. And certainly, none of these kids on the streets have any respect whatsoever for the government or for the police.
Well, can you talk about the anger that they feel, the whole issue of police? I mean, the beginning of this, the two young people who died as they were fleeing from police.
Yes. Until recently, the police approach in these districts, until recently, to two or three years ago, had been on what the previous socialist government called community policing. It was based on the idea that the individual policemen should know their areas better, they should get on better with the kids, they should not just be seen as repressive forces of law and order, but as agents of the state there to help the kids who were not involved in criminality stay away from criminality, as well as punish those who were found to be guilty. That approach is not popular with Nicolas Sarkozy, the Interior Minister, who's a very heavy law and order man. And when you talk to young men in districts like Clichy-sous-Bois and the neighboring suburbs, their number one complaint is that they are constantly being asked for their papers by the police. They regard it as harassment. They'll be hanging about in the lobbies of their apartment blocks, they say, and the police will come by and ask for their papers. The same policeman who asked for their papers 3 hours ago will ask them for their papers again. And if they don't have them, they are locked away in the police station for 4 hours, and their parents have to come and get them often before they're allowed to go home. Or, for example, the police will stop you, so one man complained about this, and feel the hood on his sweatshirt, and if it's sweaty, then he must have been running, and if he's running, he must have committed a crime. This is a sort of atmosphere that the boys themselves complain about. The police, on the other hand, say, of course, that they're in extremely difficult and sensitive neighborhoods where there's a lot of drug trafficking, there's a lot of dealing in stolen goods of all descriptions, and that they're there to stop it.
We're talking to Peter Ford of the Christian Science Monitor. The issue of the Interior Minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, calling the kids scum, saying that the government will wage a war without mercy against them.
Yeah, well, Nicolas Sarkozy is a front runner in the Conservative UMP party for the presidency when the elections are held in 2007. His chief rival is the Prime Minister, Dominique de Villepin. And Sarkozy is clearly angling here for extreme right-wing votes as well as standard Conservative right-wing votes. But Sarkozy is a bit of an anomaly in French politics. While he has taken this very hard-line law and order position, he has also broken a lot of taboos in French politics as regards immigration. He argues in favor, for example, of positive discrimination to encourage the integration of immigrant youth into French society. Now, that is absolutely abhorrent to most of the French establishment.
Explain what you mean when you say positive discrimination. Are you talking about what we say in the United States is affirmative action?
Yes, exactly. Of deliberately setting aside quotas of jobs or places in schools, universities for disadvantaged immigrants. That runs directly counter to the French tradition of treating absolutely everybody equally. But, of course, that tradition is a myth. It's enshrined in the in French ideas of equality, fraternity, and liberty. But it's totally illusory if you come from one of these ghettos on the outskirts of Paris. And Sarkozy has recognized that. But at the same time, he's playing, if you like, both sides of the gallery. And his hard-line language is designed to attract support from elsewhere in the political spectrum. It doesn't appear to be working that well. There was a poll released yesterday which showed that 50% of the French population don't think his action against insecurity has been effective. But he still retains a positive image amongst 57% of French voters.
We're talking to Peter Ford, reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. We'll come back to him in Paris, riots throughout France now. And then we are going to go down to Argentina, and we'll talk about the failed summit of the Americas. Finally, the fox in the hen house, how privatization threatens democracy. We'll talk about privatization from Iraq to the prisons to overall U.S. government policy. Stay with us.
Here I am spending my life down among the kielbasa, making your lunch meat, hot spicy sausage and dolls. You can count what I make, that's the reason they call it production. So how come it's you that's living so high on the hog? Sometimes I wonder what CEOs do in an hour. When I see your picture, you're talking away on the phone, shaking some hand or jetting away to a meeting. You're sure not down here on the floor with the gristle and bone. You make $8,825 an hour, $70,600 a day. That's more than $10 million a year. I just can't see it from here. What less you deserve to be making a killing this way.
the Gap, Sai Khan, who will be joining us for the book he co-wrote with Elizabeth Minnick, The Fox in the Hen House. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue for just a moment with Peter Ford in Paris in France, where the riots continue. Peter Ford, the issue of what is soft integration and also the level of employment and the conditions in these poorer areas of the suburbs, not only of Paris, but now spread all over the country.
Well, it's very striking when you go to these housing projects. Well, I must remember actually that these are pockets of extreme underprivilege in suburbs which themselves are not necessarily very well off, but are perhaps lower middle class. We're not talking about huge swathes of territory. But on these projects, the average income is half or a little more than half of the national average. For young men between the ages of 20 and 29, unemployment is three times higher than the national average. An interesting study was done earlier this year by a French professor who was looking at discrimination, and he sent out nearly 2,000 fictitious applications for a sales job coming allegedly from five or six different sorts of people. And he found that the obviously North African man with an Arab name was invited to job interviews five times less often than his white French counterpart. Even those who get beyond school to university or to college and do further education are finding that even the diplomas they gain do not protect them against unemployment in the way that they used to. Racial discrimination is very real in France, but it's not something that the authorities have ever really wanted to face up to.
And here you have the communities, particularly the elders of the communities, urging peace and to stop the violence. And yet what is starting this conversation is the violence, the ongoing violence. I mean, the president hasn't even spoken until very recently.
Yes, it's unclear, frankly, how much authority the preachers and the Islamic organizations have over the kids who are committing the violence. I don't think that the ones who are setting fire to these cars listen very carefully to what their imams tell them. In fact, the mosques in some of these suburbs have been themselves organizing groups of faithful younger men amongst their congregations to go out on a nightly basis and try to calm spirits, try to argue with the kids to send them home, to stop them confronting the police or burning down schools. I mean, one of the things they're telling them, of course, is that they're trashing their own neighborhoods. They're burning the buses that their neighbors use to get to work. They're burning the schools that their little brothers and sisters go to. And that this is counterproductive. But I don't think at the moment anybody seems to have sufficient authority over them to stop them doing what they're doing. And that is what has led Sarkozy to decide, right, there's only one thing to do. It's to send in more riot police. But that, as we've seen over the last few nights, isn't the answer either. It may tamp down violence in one or two places, even though it often provokes some as well, but then it pops up somewhere else.
Peter Ford, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, reporting from Paris. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we go south. Well, President Bush failed to persuade other leaders attending the Summit of the Americas meeting in Argentina this weekend to resume talks around achieving a hemisphere-wide free trade agreement. Bush was hoping to persuade his Latin American and Caribbean counterparts to endorse the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA. The FTAA would be larger than the European Union, but without the free flow of labor and political integration. The plan would get rid of tariffs and other barriers that limit entry of American goods and services, allowing U.S. exports to the region to bloom. Critics have spoken out against the FTAA, saying that it would do little to alleviate poverty in Latin America while opening up huge markets for U.S. companies. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has called the agreement an annexationist plan which would destroy local industry, roll back social safety nets and labor protections, and permanently extend U.S. political domination of the region to the economic realm. On Friday, Chavez led a rally of more than 25,000 people to protest President Bush and the FTAA. This is President Chavez.
Porque el modelo capitalista, el modelo desarrollista,
The capitalist model, the developed model, the consumer model, which comes from the North, which it has forced on the world, is falling apart on Earth, and there is no planet nearby that we can immigrate to.
Y que se sepa, no tenemos ningún planeta cercano así para que emigremos hacia allá.
The Alternative People Summit took place in Argentina last week as well. Thousands came from all over the continent to discuss issues such as opposition to imperialism, employment, wealth distribution, environmental degradation, and debt forgiveness. We're joined on the phone now from Argentina by one of the organizers of the People's Summit, Beverly Keane. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. You're coordinator with Jubilee South, one of those who organized the People's Summit. Looking now at this weekend, what do you think you accomplished?
Well, I think we have an enormously positive balance at the first sight. One of the reasons is because of the massive turnout. Participation in the People's Summit during the 3 days of debates and more than 160 workshops and seminars and forums focusing on different aspects of a popular agenda was enormous, very enthusiastic, more than 12,000 people. And a lot of those people were from the very city of Mar del Plata. And that was very encouraging because the city of Mar del Plata has been, for the past 6 months, essentially under a police alert, and the security net has been tightening and tightening and tightening, and the campaign of, in a sense, of fright and of fear, telling people that, you know, they ought to stay home, that they ought to leave, that they ought to close their businesses, et cetera, was really tremendous. So it was very, very positive that so many people from Mar del Plata, in fact, turned out, participated very actively in events, including the march, which was a tremendously large march for the city of Mar del Plata, and that's a very good sign. I think the other good, very positive evaluation that we've made is that in the course of the 3 days, and an agenda that was very much focused on building alternatives, there was a tremendous discussion in each of the sectoral forums and each of the thematic groups, and a number of very specific initiatives were launched that are becoming part of what is the continental agenda, not just to say no to the FTAA, to no to militarization, but how can we advance in some very, very concrete programs. And so that was good news. I think also, obviously, part of our positive evaluation of what took place in Mar del Plata these days is the fact that despite the immense pressure from the U.S., from the Canada, and from other countries in the region, the at least U.S.'s proposal to move forward and put a date to resuming the negotiations towards the building of the FTAA, that was not able to be pushed through. Undoubtedly, there is continuing concern here in Argentina, in the continent, and through all the social movements and organizations that participated in the summit, the fact that the FTAA still appears in the document, and the kinds of neoliberal policies that have been pursued against the interests and the rights of the people of the hemisphere over the past decade or 15 years are still very much present in the document itself, in the Declaration of the Presidents.
Beverly Keane,
we have an agenda ahead of us.
Can you talk about what Chavez was putting forward as he announced they had gathered at the gravesite of the FTAA, the Bolivarian Alternative for Latin America and the Caribbean, known as ALBA, the Spanish acronym meaning dawn, to replace the FTAA? And where do the other Latin American leaders come down on this?
Well, I think what Chavez and what he was speaking to was, in fact, a hope and at least a partial reality in the fact that the U.S. wasn't able and hasn't been able thus far to impose its agenda, which we could all remember as of the first summit of the Americas, which was held in Miami in 1994. From that time on, the U.S.'s agenda was to have the FTAA up and running by January 2005. Well, we are now in November 2005, and the FTAA is still on paper. So we're continuing, in a sense, to be able to hold it back. And Venezuela's position, the position of Chavez's government in that sense, has been very, very clear. And I think when he announces here in Mar del Plata that we have come to the gravesite, it's continuing to press in that respect. What maybe is most important coming out of the declaration of the presidents in Mar del Plata is, in fact, a very formal and a very official recognition of divided opinions among the governments of Latin America. And that means that there will be continued pressure, certainly on the governments here in the Southern Cone, Argentina, Brazil, Venezuela itself, of course, Uruguay and Paraguay, to bring about change in those positions. And this is a subject of concern. And Chavez and the Venezuelan government has a very clear alternative, a very clear position, no to the FTA under any circumstances, and is moving alternatives forward, such as you mentioned, the question of really advancing with alternative forms of integration, both in the economic sphere, in science and technology, in education, in health, in a number of different areas. And that's a real challenge for the other governments of the Southern Cone in particular, who've at least taken a firm step forward in this point to say that under existing conditions, they're not willing to continue negotiating the FTAA. Our fear, and certainly part of the target of our action over the next and coming months here in Argentina and other countries in the Southern Cone, will be to continue to bolster that opposition on the part of our governments, because the fear is that if there are, in a sense, some concessions, however minor, then indeed the floodgates may still be opened.
Beverly Keane, what about the protests? Can you talk about the level, if there was violence, how people came together, how the state, how the police responded?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to mention that there was an enormously large march and rally. We're talking, seen estimates of between 30 and 50,000 people. One of the things that many noted is that while we watched through the streets of Mar del Plata on the morning of November 4th, there wasn't a police officer in sight, quite different to what had been the reality in the three previous days as we had gathered in Mar del Plata. But the march was extraordinarily peaceful. It was, I would say, very enthusiastic. Certainly the target of the march was Bush and Bush's policies, not only in Latin America but around the world. But it was an enormously festive occasion as people were really feeling a sense of coming together from different parts of the continent, from different parts and different political organizations, different social organizations, different positions, certainly here in Argentina with respect to what is the local political scene. But there was a real sense of unity in terms of that known to Bush. The afternoon, unfortunately, saw a number of very, in a sense, minor incidents in the sense that there were very few people actually engaged. There were large marches to the valles, to the the walls that had been set up by the police to keep people out of the presidential summit. There were massive marches from the stadium after Chavez's speech back to the area where the presidents themselves were meeting. But most of the people who engaged in those marches, in fact, were not able to get as far as they had hoped because of eventual police repression. But at the time that there was acts of vandalism, certainly in Mar del Plata, what is very clear is that the police were nowhere to be seen, and they didn't show up for a long time. Here in Argentina, there's a very clear sense, and this is what you can get if you talk to neighbors in Mar del Plata, if you read what's available in the media, that in fact a kind of liberated zone was set up. Police were nowhere in sight. They weren't brought in until well after the incidents of vandalism itself were finished.
Beverly
so
Keane.
There's a sense that it was, in a sense, part of efforts to to really pressure the government itself, and particularly part of an effort to, in a sense, cast a doubt or cast a shadow over what had been enormously successful 4 days of debate, discussion among social movements and organizations from throughout the hemisphere, and an enormously successful march and rally that very morning.
Wasn't the Argentine president also actually critical of President Bush? Now, also, Bush went on to Brazil and is in Panama, where the president, Torrijos, supports the FTAA.
President Kirchner was very critical in his opening address. I haven't actually heard it, nor had a chance to read it yet. But according to many accounts, it was a very strong address, and he was very critical, certainly, his position is not only in relation to the commercial negotiations, but certainly in relation to IMF role and stance in relation to Latin America. What is a challenge for movements and organizations here in Argentina, however, is to sift through, in a sense, what often we say is the distance between rhetoric and reality. It is certainly true that the policies that the government of Argentina are moving forward are very different and a vast improvement over what we have known in prior decade, in the decade of the 90s and certainly the earlier part of this decade. But there is, I think, growing concern among many here in Argentina that while the government talks a stiff line, it's often it's not always what is the reality of its policies. And this has certainly been true in relation to questions like the debt and its fair relations with the IMF. So these are areas that we'll continue to be watching very carefully and working on very carefully and hoping to strengthen, indeed, what is both the rhetoric and also the reality of the government's policy.
Beverly Keane, I want to thank you for being with us from Argentina, coordinator of Jubilee South and on the committee, the organizing committee for the People's Summit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by Sai Khan and Elizabeth Minnick. They've written The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. Stay with us.
So many times in history, we've watched them march away. Some cry out for victory, some just stand and pray. For this father's daughter, for this mother's son. What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? Some are quick to honor, some are quick to blame. Few can face the truth that this all happens in our name. Before the first shot's fired, our battle has begun. What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is over? What will happen to the rest of us when the war is done? Those who fight the battles,
When the War is Done, by folk singer Sai Khan, also author Sai Khan, who joins us in the studio now with Elizabeth Minnick. They are authors of the new book, The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the issue of privatization, they talk about the damage privatization has done in several areas of society, including schools, prisons, and military. They argue instead of privatization serving the public good, it rewards powerful corporations intent on replacing the government with a private profit culture in which there's limited public accountability. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Amy, it's wonderful to be on Democracy Now!
It's good to have you with us. Why don't we start by connecting what we've really been talking on the program today, just in Argentina, talking about the protests against the Fair Trade Area of the Americas, to Iraq and what we're seeing now, the latest there with the level of deaths now for U.S. servicemen and women over 2,000, for Iraqis unknown but believed to be over 100,000.
Amy, In The Fox and the Hen House, we're making an argument that we think is somewhat different. Don't think about privatization in terms of the usual arguments that the government gives, that were given by the corporations, which say, oh, this is about saving money for the taxpayers, this is about efficiency. What we are doing is the largest transfer of public wealth to private pockets in the history of this country. We are seeing this in Iraq, where the goal of this administration is to see how much of the money that should be going to all sorts of other issues and other causes can be put into private pockets. Think Halliburton. Think Lockheed Martin. This is what is going on. And it is the undermining of public space, of the public good, of public welfare. It is a deliberate strategy to undermine the ground that belongs to all of us, the Commonwealth, the commons, those things that create public good, that create a humane society.
Elizabeth Minnick, talk about why you think this undermines democracy and how the media deals with this, if people in this country are understanding the shift of the public commons to private sphere.
The most important thing to emphasize over and over again is precisely that shift from the public, that which belongs to us, that services, goods, values that we have held dear, that we have government established to protect and to provide for us, being opened up to for-profit exploitation. And in which case, two things key happen. One is goods that are supposed to be for the people, that we set aside, that we established as rights for the people, which is democratic to the core, being taken over by for-profit corporations for private pockets, dispersed away from the people most directly affected. This is anti-democratic in the extreme. The whole notion of shrinking government that they talk about, it's about shrinking government that's responsive to the people. It's not about shrinking the powers of government. With the media, we see, you know this, of course, infinitely better than I do, but the whole notion of public airwaves, analogous strictly to public lands and to rights, to the exercise of freedom, of the multiple kinds of freedom. Hand that over to for-profit, and it is, by definition, not run democratically.
Sai Khan, Hurricane Katrina, and how this fits into your picture.
Amy, part of what I love is the common argument that, oh, the administration wasn't prepared. They were absolutely prepared for Katrina, but they were prepared for an agenda that they were prepared to move. Here's what I think is remarkable about the Bush administration and their cronies. They take every disaster, they take every national trauma as an opportunity to move forward on a privatization agenda, a centralization agenda, an authoritarian agenda. So in Katrina, the response that we're seeing is not a humanitarian response. It's not a humane response. It is, let's see how much contracts, sole source contracts, can be given to Halliburton, to Lockheed Martin, to Walmart, to Home Depot. And we just see the proposal to take $2.6 billion to create vouchers that would allow the children of the Gulf Coast to go to private schools all over the country. The Bush administration has been struggling to privatize education, let's say that for what it is, to destroy public education and to put education in the hands of for-profit corporations. And they're taking advantage of this extraordinary disaster, this human tragedy, to move $2.6 billion into private corporations for education.
Can you compare the response to Hurricane Katrina to what happened after September 11th?
I think it's absolutely parallel. After September 11th, I think so many of us, progressives, and just good Americans said, this is a time of national grief. This is a national tragedy. This is a time for mourning. And many of us said, this is not a time to score political points. This is not a time to try to move an agenda. We were naive in that because the Bush administration, within 24 hours, was moving towards the homeland security system, the so-called homeland security system. Security in a democracy is freedom, is public space, is public good. And they were moving towards the Patriot Act. They take our human response to disaster, where our hearts reach out, and they reach out with their pocketbooks.
May I add something to this?
Elizabeth.
One of the important things that we saw with FEMA that it's harder to see with 9/11, but was also in action, is that the privatization agenda, it's not just, as Sai was saying, something that happens here and there as a technique. It is a political agenda to destroy, push back democracy, and put in its place for-profit culture, corporations, anti-democratic. With FEMA, what we saw is the same thing we found in our research in all the different areas of privatization, which is first you break it, if you're a privatizer, and then you say, oh dear, it's broken. The public doesn't work. Government can't run anything. Hand it over to the corporations with the whole mythology about how efficient and effective they are. They broke FEMA. We know this story now by putting in political cronies, by defunding, by removing it from the seats of power, so that when it was desperately needed, it didn't work well. And the person they had put in charge didn't help it work well, but it had also been defunded and disempowered. Then you say, oh, we need help, so we go to the private. They do the same thing with the schools. You defund. Like on the international scene, you use debt. You defund. You make people dependent on sources of other money, not government, not public money. Then you pull the strings. You impose more regulations and rules. You swamp them so that they break. The people get mad at them because they're not doing their job. And then you say, you know who could do this well? The efficient, the effective, the corporations.
We're talking to Elizabeth Minnick and Cy Khan. They've written The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. Why The Fox and the Hen House?
The old story is you don't set the fox to guard the chickens. Well, what struck us while we were doing this research across all of these areas, military, schools, welfare, for heaven's sakes, public lands, public airways, public, was that the fox was no longer even being put forward as the guard of the hen house. The fox was in the hen house. And we had one particular story that, you know, the eureka moment when you say, this is it. We're reading about Lockheed Martin, huge armament manufacturer, which also does things like welfare and things these days, which is absurd. There's an article in which the president of Lockheed Martin is saying with great pride, and no sense that you shouldn't be saying this right out in public, which tells you where we are, that they're not only, of course, selling hugely to this administration, mm-hmm. but that they sit in on the policy decisions. They're there. Now that literally is the fox in the hen house.
Cy Khan, you're a longtime community organizer, and one of the areas you've worked in is prisons. Talk about for-profit prisons.
Amy, of all the privatization issues, this is the one that hits me in the gut the hardest. The idea that private corporations build prisons in a cornfield somewhere, and then they go out looking for people to put in that prison in order to make money, I find that that crosses any human line. And it draws the parallels between our foreign policy, our policy with Abu Ghraib, all of these things. It's a complete violation of human rights in every sense. And yet it's endemic in the United States. Something like 120,000 people in our country are imprisoned for profit. I've been working for 25 years at grassroots leadership. We do civil rights, labor, and community organizing in the South. For the last 6 years, we've been working on a campaign to abolish for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers, and the key word here is abolish. Part of what is remarkable here is that faith voices, for example, the Presbyterian Church USA, not usually thought of as a radical or left-leaning church, in its General Assembly voted to abolish all for-profit private prisons, jails, and detention centers. And it raises the core question of privatization. Is everything for sale? Is everything that we now have any voice in whatsoever, whether imperfectly or not, our schools, our lands, our governance, our ability to govern ourselves, even to some extent, will it all be sold back to us for a profit?
Give some concrete examples. And you begin your chapter on for-profit prisons by talking about a case that we covered years ago in Syracuse, New York, of a man who was brought in for, I think it was theft.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about the story years ago, but precisely there was a cover story in the New York Times recently that was enormously useful in moving this forward. A man, I believe what he did was break into his ex-wife's house to get his skis or something to that effect, and he had a serious medical condition. The prison health services privatized, private prison, all of this run for profit, contracted out, owned. They decided he wasn't really sick. They decided he was malingering. They decided he was using this. They didn't give him his medicines. The man died.
He had Parkinson's.
Was it Parkinson's? Yeah. It's really a terrifying thing. The whole notion that gets repeated time and again is that the privatizing corporations can do a better job. People ask us this every time, but aren't they more efficient? No, they do not do a better job.
Mm-hmm. So the prison health service, which was a private health contractor, mm-hmm. didn't give him his medicine.
And the record, there were follow-up reports, and there have been many such studies. Mm-hmm. In every single area of privatization where there are these intense studies, the myth of we do it better collapses. And there is, there's blood on this agenda. It kills.
And efficiency in corporate terms means efficiency in generating a profit. It means efficiency in returning the maximum amount of money to the corporate directors and executives and to the majority shareholders. So, for example, in the case of private prisons, this means keeping them full at all costs. As a result, what we have is people transported thousands and thousands of miles from home for the convenience of the private prison. I remember talking at a Jobs with Justice conference with a woman from Hawaii whose nephew, a Hawaiian, was in a private prison in Arizona. And this young man's mother had sold her house to buy an air ticket to go visit him. Now, from the corporation's point of view, that's efficiency because they're balancing their occupancy. From any human or humane point of view, that's across the line.
We're talking to Cy Khan and Elizabeth Minnick about The Fox and the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. On the issue of war right now, on the issue of Iraq, can you talk specifically how the corporations are benefiting? You have a very interesting chapter, and I think what's most interesting are the details.
Mm-hmm. A number of different areas in which private corporations are making monstrous profits. Halliburton is being covered. Brown & Root is all over the newspapers now, so we probably don't even need to mention that. It's war profiteering of the first order. The contractors that we hear about regularly, we're talking about mercenaries. We're talking about people who are fighting for pay. They are hired. There are large private military firms, international, supranational. They like now to call themselves security firms, so you'll hear security personnel. They're private military companies. The U.S. military is said by those who have studied it to be probably the most privatized military in the world, and a lot of that came out of Iraq. Mosul, you want to talk about Mosul?
I was going to do the recent quote from an active three-star general about 3 weeks ago in The Economist that Elizabeth's father sent us. He said, you know, these private so-called security firms, they're actually mercenaries. They are driving through the streets of Iraq armed with automatic weapons. He says, they get scared, they get trigger happy, they take aim at civilians, people die. And we have to risk our volunteer forces to send in and get them out of the trouble that they caused. And he said, do you know what? They are not subject to Iraqi law, and they are not subject to the U.S. Code of Military Conduct. He says, there's nothing we can do when they kill an Iraqi civilian except terminate the contract. So this is part of what's going on. It means that we have mercenaries who are completely and totally out of control.
Some of those have now shown up, of course, in New Orleans. You've seen those stories. And the same thing happens. They're not subject to military, to public control. And they put the people who are working on public payroll at an enormous risk because they are out of control, and they create incidents that then have to be stopped.
We just have 30 seconds. And your research over years on privatization, what surprised you most?
That they're serious about wanting it all, that Grover Norquist means it about shrinking government to where we can drown it in a bathtub. Amy, we are trying to use James Baldwin's phrase, we're trying to ring the fire bell in the night. We're trying to sound the alarm. We're saying they are serious about taking over this country and about operating it. Their vision is of an America owned and operated by the corporations, and we have got to stand and fight back.
Cy Khan, Elizabeth Minnick, the authors of The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org. We are also podcasting there, video and audio. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Chris Zucker. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, at our website, you can sign up for our daily headlines as well as our media alerts. I'm Amy Goodman. This is democracynow.org, Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.